I want you to imagine for just a moment that everything you think you know about the human race just might be wrong. In a moment, we'll be talking with Joseph Farrell, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men on Coast to Coast AM. And let's introduce Joseph Farrell. Recognized scholar, credentials include a PhD in philosophy from the University of Oxford, a very world-renowned researcher with an eye to assimilate tremendous amount of background material. Joseph is able to condense the best scholastic research and publication, and he brings in insightful new conclusions on very complex and controversial subjects. Noted author, he's been on the program before. Tonight we're going to be talking about Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. Here's Joseph Farrell on Coast to Coast. Joseph, how are you?
Pretty good, George. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And, of course, your buddy Richard C. Hoagland always sends his regards. And
I
noticed he's part of the acknowledgement in this new book. He's quite an inspiration, isn't he?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I need to make two acknowledgements about this book. Richard, of course, and I talk a lot privately, and, of course, he's always made a tremendous contribution to my thinking. And there's another individual I want to mention, a good friend of mine by the name of Dr. Scott DeHart, that we met more or less because of our common background from the University of Oxford. And so this book is also kind of a product of the collaboration and discussions that we've had over the years. And incidentally, George, Scott and I just finished a book that was received by one of our publishers today. It'll be out at the end of May, and that's going to be called The Grid of the Gods. So it's kind of a second effort and an official first collaboration in my series of research with another author.
Okay, great. Well, our EP, Lisa's probably noting that right now, so she'll be on your back.
we'll make sure you get a copy.
You know, as I was reading the title, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, and then reading the book, I noticed under your name the subtitle, which is The Surviving Elites of the Cosmic War and Their Hidden Agenda. I went, whoa, what's that all about? Tell me about that.
Well, that's an interesting question, George. Really, this book kind of stands in an arch of books, as you know, that I've been writing concerning ancient history that really began with a book of mine called The Cosmic War, in which I discussed the idea that there was actually an interplanetary war long ago inside the solar system. And I got to thinking that if that were true, then if we use the analogy of World War II, you had, at the end of World War II, you had surviving elites on both sides of the war and trying to stitch things back together in Europe and the Pacific as best as they could. And so I've used that as kind of a model to go back and look at ancient history and see if we can find traces of similar activities there. And I really began that process with my book, Babylon's Banksters. As you know, I think George Knapp had me on interviewing about that on your show.
Right.
And this book kind of continues in that line. I'm looking at what I call the activities of these elites trying to reconstruct civilization, to jumpstart it again, get it going. So what I look at is not only genetic engineering that's suggested in ancient texts, but I'm also looking at other activities. It's very interesting that one of the activities that I noticed very early on was they were interested in constructing a reliable, reduplicatable system of weights and measures around the globe in order to conduct commerce. So you have a clear indication there that you've got some sort of elite operating behind the scenes. And then in the coming book, The Grid of the Gods, that my friend Scott and I wrote, we're looking at other aspects of that elite building, you know, all the megalithic constructions around the world. So it's a very complex topic.
Do you trust the elitists at all, Joseph?
Well, in a word, no. The reason why is, you know, if you look at the activity of these people, George, throughout history, and it's not just within modern history, and I'm glad you asked the question, because if you look at their activity in ancient history, they're pretty much up to the same old game that they are now. They're suppressing technology, they're suppressing science, they're essentially monopolizing things for themselves, and doing so in a way, at least in some cases, I think, to aggrandize their own power and hegemony. So, in a word, no, I don't trust them. I think the pattern is fairly consistent throughout history.
What do you think they want, Joseph? I mean, they've got more money than God. They live where they want to live. What do they want to play around with us for?
Well, the more I look at it, George, the more I think that there has been some sort of long-term agenda. And this is kind of what I hint at beginning in The Cosmic War, and certainly in this book, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. I think there's been a long-term agenda since ancient times to get humanity back to a very sophisticated state of civilization so that essentially they can reach out themselves to the stars. I think this is their goal. I think they want to at least get themselves off this planet. I don't think that they're really terribly concerned about the rest of us.
No, not at all. There was once a German architect. He was an amateur archaeologist. His name was Robert Koldewey.
Yes.
You talk about his conundrum. What is that?
Well, first part of the chapter of the book is an examination of kind of setting up the problem that scientists, archaeologists, and so on noticed. And Robert Koldewey was a German archaeologist. He was actually the man, George, that discovered the Ishtar Gate at Babylon. So the problem that he ran into, George, is that on that gate there are two creatures depicted. And one of them is a monster called the Sirish. This is, and I have pictures of this in the book. This monster, George, is nothing less than chimerical because it's got the forepaws of a feline of some sort. It's got the hind legs of some sort of bird. Huh. And then, on top of all of this, as if that's not bad enough, it's got a tail that looks kind of like a scorpion's sting and the head of a dragon. Now, the problem that Dr. Koldewey had was when he discovered this occurs in the context of other animals that are real, number one. And number two, the second part of the problem is that this animal, unlike a lot of mythological creations that you find in Mesopotamian art, this animal did not change in its depiction over the millennia. It was always consistent. And this led Koldewey to the conclusion that what the Babylonians had been trying to depict was some sort of extinct creature, possibly a dinosaur, possibly an iguanodon. And that, of course, raised other problems because at that time, of course, the dinosaurs were long extinct. So, you know, where did the Babylonians get this idea for this very strange chimerical creature? So Koldewey actually published a book about his archaeological findings, and he argued basically that this creature, whatever it was, had to have been real for them to have depicted it in a context with other real creatures. And so that's kind of how I launched the book into this whole problem of ancient engineering and the possibility that these ancient cultures actually knew about the existence of dinosaurs and other creatures.
These creatures, that do you think there are any of them roaming around now?
Another excellent question. And, you know, George, that's such a fascinating question. It really, I think, would require a book of its own. And one of the things that I ran into is the research of Ivan Sanderson that many of your listeners will probably be familiar
sure.
with. And Sanderson, for many years, George, maintained that there were so many reports and legends of very strange creatures, even resembling dinosaurs, coming out of Africa in particular, that there had to have been some basis, in fact, behind them. And even though I didn't talk about these reports in the book, because I discovered that, you know, to have done so would have required a book of its own, there are literally thousands of these reports, George. And I think that, yeah, you have to at least allow the possibility that some of these things might be around to this day. You know, my word, about 20 years ago, we had the case where fishermen discovered the case of the coelacanth, you know, which was supposedly extinct for 200 million years, and then all of a sudden they catch one.
Yeah.
know, that kind of blew the lid off of the theory. So, yeah, I think we have to credit these reports.
Oh, Joseph, I'm still convinced that Nessie out there in Loch Ness in Scotland is probably prehistoric.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm of the same opinion, George, because I think if you recall, there was a submarine that they sent down or a camera that they sent down that took a picture of a large fin that looked like the fin mm-hmm. off of an ancient dinosaur. So, yeah, I tend to agree with you.
You know, that was kind of poo-pooed, too. It was a picture that was a National Geographic.
Yes.
I think it was Japanese folks who took that picture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you would have thought, Joseph, that the world would have gone wild with that, and they didn't. It had the fin of a plesiosaur, didn't it?
Yeah. And George, I think the reason there, and I get into this a bit in the book, I think the reason there is that we are looking at a bit of a cover-up. I think that there is such a vested interest in maintaining the status quo and maintaining the standard models of human evolution and the progress and history of civilization, that finding these things, finding these anomalies, just has to be suppressed. I mean, my word, you've had Michael Cremo and Richard Thompson on your show talking about forbidden archaeology and all the evidence that they've uncovered that mankind, or at least some genetic cousin of ours, was here on this planet long, long before modern man even came about. So I think you're looking at a bit of a vested interest on the part of the academic powers that be that want to suppress this evidence, because it raises a lot of questions. I mean, we have to admit, it raises a lot of questions, not only about the standard scientific models of history, but it raises a lot of questions about religion as well.
I've seen some pictures on the internet of what could be skeletons of giants, Joseph, and I say to myself, this could be Photoshop.
Sure.
But I'm just not sure.
Well, you know, that's another interesting point, George, and I'm so glad you mentioned it, because one of the things I do in the book is I try to avoid talking about pictures or supposed evidence of these things. What I'm really interested in looking at are the ancient legends and lore concerning
right.
these creatures. And there we're dealing with something very, very unique and something very interesting. Because if you go to Mesoamerica, for example, and examine the legends of the Aztecs or the Mayans or even the Hopi in North America, they all record a conflict, an actual war with the giants. Now, what's really interesting to me, George, is I ran across a scholar. Her name is Adrienne Mayer, and she wrote a series of just wonderful, wonderful books about this very topic. And she points out that in the lore and legends of Mesoamerica, this war against the giants was fought, in their own words, because of the sexual practices of the giants. And I'm thinking, well, my word, you know, that's almost sounding like the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Mm-hmm.
And, add to that the fact that they are saying that this is a war against giants. That reminds you, of course, and I noticed your website that you put up the Greek version of the war against the giants, the Gigantomachy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have to explain something else here, and that is, why is it that we have the legends of this war against the giants with the Greeks, and then half a world and an ocean away, we find the same legends among completely different cultures with Aztecs and Mayans? So I have to conclude that there's some sort of basis in fact behind all of these things long, long ago in prehistory.
And, you know, and you look at the Bible, you look at Genesis, and
right.
it talks about the giants of, it had to have been something, Joseph. It had to have been something.
Well, yeah, you know, this is the thing, George. With the Greek version of the story, we're kind of back again to the idea of cosmic war, and this is the reason I put this book in that series as a kind of a sequel to that book, because in the Greek version of this war, you have, of course, Saturn or Kronos being the principal god at the beginning of the Greek pantheonic history. And then, of course, Kronos sires a race of giants, and there's a large war. And that war had to have been fought, in my opinion, on an interplanetary basis millennia, if not millions of years ago. So what we're looking at with these legends, I think, all over the world is kind of a vague retelling of something that is so ancient that it kind of got garbled in the transmission. But yeah, I agree. I think you have to look at all these texts, including the Bible, from the standpoint of, you know, critically reassessing what they're saying and comparing notes and details between them. But there's no question in my mind that you're right, that there is some sort of factual basis behind all of these things.
You know, the old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. With these
yes.
myths, there's got to be some basis behind it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is the real clue that we're dealing with something like this, because over and over again, George, I run into the fact that these completely different cultures that are so disconnected from each other geographically and even culturally to a certain extent, that they are repeating the same details. How do we account for the fact that in the Bible we have stories of giants, we have stories of very strange sexual practices, and then again, in an ocean and half a world away, we have the same story being told by Aztecs and Mayans?
You know, that's right.
There's just no way that this can be coincidental.
What is the dilemma that you talk about? Delicitz?
Delitzsch's dilemma. That's also in chapter one with Professor Koldewey. And Friedrich Delitzsch, just to kind of set this up so that people really understand the full significance of what he actually discovered. Friedrich Delitzsch was one of the world's great, great Assyriologists. He was fluent in virtually all forms of the languages behind ancient cuneiform. He was very fluent with Sumerian and Akkadian and Assyrian and so on. And Friedrich Delitzsch was, of course, one of these German archaeologists that had spent some time in Mesopotamia digging around and making discoveries. He was called to Berlin to give a private audience on his discoveries to Kaiser Wilhelm II and the imperial court, okay?
Right.
And this is where the story gets really interesting, because Delitzsch, in this private lecture, recorded and reported on the fact that he had found some cuneiform tablets dating from the time of King Hammurabi, which would be about 1,000 years before the books of Genesis and Exodus were written, if you follow certain conservative datings of those books. And in these cuneiform tablets, he found a version of the Old Testament name of God, Yahweh, clearly present, all right? And word of this leaked out of the Kaiser's court into the public and caused a literal firestorm of controversy, George, all throughout Europe, from Germany to France to England. Everybody was in an uproar at what he had found. And the reason why they were in an uproar, I mean, he had everybody from biblical critics to liberal theologians all mad at him, you know, and that takes a bit of doing to get everybody mad.
Sure does. That's right.
Well, the reason why they were mad at him is, of course, on the one hand, if you were kind of a fundamentalist turn of mind, the name Yahweh is always understood in traditional theology to be a special revelation that God gave to the Hebrews, and then, of course, that tradition was picked up in Christianity. So by saying that this name was nothing special and that it was around 1,000 years before the Hebrews even came along, that was quite shocking enough. But the other problem was that by saying it was 1,000 years older than the first two books of the Bible, he was also saying that all the attempts of the biblical scholars and critics who had been trying to redate the books of the Bible to hundreds of years after the Exodus from Egypt, that this was also wrong. Yeah, the dilemma that he posed for scholars, and they've never really been able to resolve it ever since, is why is this name present in a Sumerian and Mesopotamian context so very, very early?
You've tied in genetic manipulation with the
yes.
elitists and many of the things that had gone on in the past. We're coming up to the break, Joseph, but when we come back, I want you to tell us what you think the ancients did in terms of genetic manipulation and what's going on now. We'll be back in a moment with our guest tonight, Joseph Farrell, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating program. Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men with Joseph Farrell. We'll talk with him a little bit about those FBI vault reports as well. Let me tell you some of his works. The Giza Death Star Destroyed, Secrets of the Unified Field, The Philadelphia Experiment, The Nazi Bell and the Discarded Theory, Nazi International, Roswell and the Reich, Babylon's Banksters, he was on with George on that, not the other George, and Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, which is what we're talking about tonight. He's a very accomplished research author, and we'll be back with Joseph Farrell in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph, you have done some extensive research into all these areas. How did you get involved in all of this?
Well, I've always been interested in it, George, and I used to be a college professor, and when I first started writing this series of books, I did so originally as a kind of a lecture that a friend of mine that I was team teaching a seminar with at the University of Oklahoma, she convinced me to actually give a lecture on some of these ideas to the class, and the class loved it. So at her insistence and a few other friends' insistence, when I quit college teaching, I decided I'd bite the bullet and start writing these ideas down. So that's how it came about.
Oh, that's great. Did you like college teaching for a while?
Yes, I did. I really enjoy teaching. The thing that I never really enjoyed about it was all the politics
I know. And you know what I'm concerned about, too, now is they're pumping out these great kids with these great degrees and all these varied areas. I don't think there are any jobs for them, are there?
Well, this, sadly, is the problem. We've managed to ship so much of our manufacturing base overseas, George, that the jobs are simply not there, and I agree with you. We've got to take a very serious look at our economic policy and our educational policy, for that matter, because it's in need of some dire overhaul.
Yeah, I get emails from a lot of college students who are writing term reports and papers. And one of the things they would like to do is they send me an email, Joseph, and they say, do you mind if I can interview you for 15 minutes for my college paper? And, of course, I say, look, we can do it either by email or, you know, here's another number you can call me at. I'll be here at this number. And they write up their reports for their specific class, whatever it might be, history, biology, because our subjects, as you know, are so varied. And it breaks my heart because, you know, at the end, they always ask me the same question, and that is, what are my job prospects like when I graduate? And, gosh, I don't want to tell them. I just, what do you say?
Yeah, it's very difficult, George, and you know, we're all in this together, and we have to convince our political leaders that a lot of the economic policy that they've been following, principally in the name of free trade, that they've got to take a very serious look at some of these things, because the jobs have to come back to this country. They just really do.
Yeah, we really should. And then I think we need an aggressive way of helping people in other countries so they can eat and drink water and things like that while we're taking care of our own people. We need to do that. Anyway, let's get your take on some of the other work that you've done. And I do want to ask you later on tonight, Joseph, about the FBI's new vault, where they released some UFO reports, and I want to get your take on that. But tell me about your thoughts of genetic engineering from the ancients. What did they do, if anything?
Well, George, you know, this to me is really the big issue, because, as you know, from various people that have researched this subject, Zechariah Sitchin and some others, the ancient texts, and I spend a great deal of time in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men talking about a set of tablets, cuneiform tablets called the Karsag tablets, that if you interpret them from a certain point of view, certainly seem to suggest that there is some genetic engineering that took place. And these texts, just to kind of give the details, these texts indicate that there were kind of prototypical proto-human mothers that were selected, and then a member of the Anunnaki, or whatever you wish to call that group of people, that donated the male component, and that essentially that modern humanity is a genetically engineered and created creature. And furthermore, if you look at these texts, they suggest something very, very disturbing. And incidentally, in The Grid of the Gods that my friend Scott and I are releasing at the end of May, I examined the same legend, and it's certainly found in the Mayan texts, and almost in the same way, all right? So in other words, we're not looking at something that is restricted to Mesopotamian legends. This is something that you also find in the legends and lore of other cultures. And if this be the case, then we're looking at a disturbing thing, because the first thing that these texts, all from the Mayans to the Mesopotamians, state is that mankind was created as a kind of a slave to serve the gods, all right?
Yep.
And this is, number one, the first problem, because in effect what that is saying is that from the ancient point of view, we have, number one, genetic cousins out there somewhere, and number two, we are property, all right? Now, that in itself raises an interesting issue, because one of the things I did in the book, George, is I compared the modern genome war that took place between the Public Genome Project and the private race that was led by Craig Venter of Valera Corporation. And in the process of examining that, I looked at American patent law. And American patent law, if you patent a gene, under patent law, the invention has to be duplicatable by the hand of man. Number two, it cannot arise in nature, and it must have had the hand of man in the invention so that it can be patentable. Well, if you apply these concepts to the ancient texts, you find that all the texts would be able to be adjudicated under American patent law and a patent awarded for basically the creation of mankind. So again, we come down to the fact that the implication legally is that we are property. So I kind of leave the question open in the book that if our cousins were to come back, you know, how would law adjudicate this? Because it is a potential problem. Now, the other thing that the text mentions, George, is very, very crucial, is that this is a wholesale program. This is not just the engineering or the manipulation of human DNA. This is something that they're doing across the board with all sorts of species. There's an ancient Babylonian historian by the name of Berosus, and he's even cited and quoted in many of the early church fathers. And Berosus maintains in his text that not only do you have an engineering of mankind, but you have the engineering of very chimerical species of blending humanity with animals and so on and so forth. So in other words, what we're looking at, George, with modern science, and I find this to be equally disturbing, we are looking really at a science that seems to be designed, in my opinion, to bring to reality the mythological creations of the past. So in other words, again, that raises the bar considerably, because what it's implying is that these ancient texts are in fact talking about a reality that happened. So, you know, it's a very complex question, because we are dealing today, in other words, with the same sorts of ethical problems that were being dealt with in very, very ancient times and in the mists of prehistory. And that's the problem.
Now, as civilizations began to evolve over the years, they seem to have lost this knowledge until here we are today. What happened in between?
Well, this is the problem that I start prying into, really, in Babylon's Banksters. And again, this book is trying to pry the lid off even more, and then the sequel to it, The Grid of the Gods, is going to pry it off even more. To me, George, I think, again, all of this is arguing that you're looking at the activity of at least one elite, if not more, that has been in more or less continual existence since ancient times. And again, the behavior of all elites throughout history is to try and preserve knowledge for themselves and leak as much of it as they dare to the public to maintain their own power. I think this is what's going on. And I think certainly you could argue a case. I certainly do not advance it as a dogmatic case, but only as a speculative possibility. I think you could advance the possibility that many of the ancient systems of belief were created simply to mask the activity of this elite, to disguise it, as it were, behind religion, behind mystery schools, behind mm-hmm. temples and priesthoods and so on. And I certainly suggest that in the book.
Well, you know, I was going to say, do you think the gods of ancient times mm-hmm. were simply visitors primarily visitors?
I incline to that view, George, and here's why. If you look at these ancient texts, for the most part, they are describing people. They are describing conscious beings with emotions, with feelings, with agendas, and you know, like all intelligent beings, they fight and argue amongst themselves and so on and so forth. That said, I do think that you have to hold open the possibility as well that many of these ancient legends are telling the truth when they say that these beings are, to some degree, spiritual beings as well. They come from, if you will, other dimensions. They might be angels, they might be demons, and so on and so forth. So I think, to kind of sum it up, that you're really looking at three classes of things. You're looking at genetic cousins, in other words, human-like beings with whom we share some genetic compatibility that makes all this engineering possible. And then secondly, I think you're looking at deeper possible entities, that you're looking at gods in the proper sense. You're looking at angels or what have you, because some of these beings can't be classified, if you examine the text carefully, as corporeal beings like we are. So I think you have to hold open all possibilities.
Why us? Why, if they came through other dimensions or they came from other planetary systems, why here, Joseph?
Another good question, and increasingly, George, I think it's because there is something special and unique about this place and about humanity. This is over and over again the conclusion, the weight of the evidence that ancient lore suggests. And my word, when I say ancient lore, I mean everything from the Vedic texts of India to the legends and lore of China and Japan to Mesoamerica. They're all more or less universal in saying that there's something special about this place and something special about humanity that draws these others here. But the problem, George, is they're not unanimous in what they think that special thing is, and that's the problem.
Well, that's true. But let's go back a little bit. Let's go to the Bible.
Sure.
Let me throw out some things. Tell me what you think might have happened, Joseph. Ezekiel's wheel. What the heck were they looking at?
Well, I increasingly take the view that we are looking at descriptions of technologies. Ezekiel's wheel is very interesting to me because it perfectly illustrates the concept of dynamic torsion, because the way that Ezekiel's wheel is described as a wheel within a wheel, in other words, a system of rotation within another system of rotation, well, that's an exact description of what physicists would call dynamic torsion, because that's all dynamic torsion is a rotating system within another rotating system. And in fact, that's the physics basis that I've argued in my book, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, was behind the Nazi Bell device. I believe it was some sort of torsion field manipulating device. So I increasingly take the view, George, that we have to look at all of those ancient texts, particularly from that region of the world, Mesopotamia and Egypt and so on and so forth. And I include the Bible in that. I think we have to hold open the possibility, let's put it that way, to hold open the possibility that we are looking at descriptions of technologies that are in many cases being used to manipulate the creation of a religious perception of these things. In other words, technologies are being used to create religions. So, you know, that's one possibility. I think you have to look at everything from that region of the world that's describing things that could be technological. I think you have to hold open the possibility that that's exactly what they were.
The Vedic texts talk about Vimanas. What were
they? Vimanas are the Sanskrit word for a flying craft, and I don't talk about the Vimanas that much in Gene Steinem's Monsters Men. I do talk about it in some of my earlier books in this series, because Vimanas, basically, if you read the Vedic text, George, the Vimanas are aircraft that are powered by mercury vortexes, and again, I find that so very interesting because in my own personal research on the Nazi Bell project, I have come to the conclusion that the substance they were putting into that device was some compound of mercury and perhaps thorium oxide that they were spinning up into a vortex. So, again, you have in these Vedic texts just these fantastic descriptions, George, of technological devices, including descriptions that are accurate to a T of the consequences of the explosion of nuclear weapons. You have descriptions of radioactive fallout. out. You have descriptions of pottery that shatters and breaks if you touch it, and of course that's a signature of extremely high gamma ray exposure. It's a signature of neutron radiation, and so on and so forth. So these Vedic texts, to me, George, are perhaps the most interesting, because they're so old, and they're based on even older oral traditions. So again, you have another indicator that you have a cosmic war that was fought, you have an elite that survived it and preserved all of this knowledge.
In Abydos, in Egypt,
yes,
there are copper tablets that you've probably have seen, Joseph. These things look like flying machines, submarines, helicopters.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know what you would describe them as other than modern craft like this or submarines.
Well, yes, that's quite true. And again, I think that this is another indicator that these people are recording the memories either of things that they have seen or that their tradition has handed down to them as technological devices. And, you know, let's go a little bit further here in I'll pry off the lid a little bit more of Genes and Giants and then Grid of the Gods. Because in Genes and Giants, one of the things I talk about in connection with the ancient texts and their suggestions of genetic engineering is the technologies that they describe that they're using. And in one author's research that I uncovered about the Karsag tablets, they're describing things that could be nothing else other than either a microscope or a genetic gene sequencer, all right? Because they're describing it as a very powerful light. In other words, they're using lights as you would in a microscope and as you would in a laser sequencer. So they're describing technologies, George, and this is the crucial point. And if we go, if I can pry the lid off of the Grid of the Gods a little bit here, one of the interesting sites that many of your listeners may be familiar with is a place in Bolivia near Lake Titicaca called Pumapunku.
Yes.
And at Pumapunku, George, there are these enormous stone blocks with 90-degree angles in them that they're all identical. They're designed to fit together like three-dimensional jigsaw puzzles. And the tolerances in the corners where all, you know, you have three planes meeting in a corner at 90 degrees is within 0.01 of a millimeter. So in other words, these things, George, had to have been machined.
Oh.
And they're tens of thousands of years old. So we are looking at clear evidences of a technology. We are looking at clear evidences of a very high civilization in ancient times. There's no denying this. You can say what you will about the texts, but when you're confronting the texts with hard evidence of the existence of a technology, this is what makes the reading of these texts as technological descriptions possible. That's why I choose to read them that way.
Is it possible that mankind, like Cremo has said, that we're hundreds of millions of years old, not hundreds of thousands of years old, and that we possess technology, something happened to us, a catastrophe, what have you, and it was gone, obliterated?
Right. Well, George, that's an excellent question, and I actually address that at some length at the very end of Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. Because let's go back to the Mesopotamian stories of genetic engineering.
All right, and let's stop you right there, Joseph, because we're going to come back. We're going to hit this top of the hour break. We're going to come right back with you, and we're going to talk about this incredible story. If mankind is much older than people say, what happened to us, and what did they have? We'll be back in a moment with Joseph Farrell on Coast to Coast AM. And we are, of course, talking with recognized scholar and author Joseph Farrell tonight about ancients, giants, mythology, you name it. We're doing it on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph, for the last hour, we're talking about civilizations that could be hundreds of millions of years older than most people think.
Uh-huh.
And could they have then possessed technology which would have allowed them to do some of these incredible things we've been talking about? But then they got obliterated. Some calamity, something happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the whole premise here that I've been following, George, is that the calamity, in my opinion, was an actual war that decimated that society. In other words, I'm not in the catastrophist school. I don't think it was natural causes as much as it was deliberate action of a society that had possession of extremely sophisticated technology and extremely destructive weaponry. But that said, one of the things that before the break that you asked was really a great question, and it's very important to the subject of genes, giants, monsters, and men. In fact, I spend the last chapter of the book trying to figure out how do you harmonize the findings of researchers like Cremo that have indicated from archaeology that there are artifacts of intelligent beings that were here long, long before any recorded history begins. In some cases, we're dealing with artifacts that are millions of years old. So this is long, long before mankind himself in his modern form is even on the scene. Geneticists think that modern Homo sapiens was around for, 150 to 200,000 years ago, somewhere in that range. So if we're looking at artifacts that are millions of years ago, we're looking at two things, exactly as you say. We're looking at a sophisticated culture. We're looking at a sophisticated technology. And we're also looking at human beings that are somehow, in my opinion, and this is the way I attempt to resolve this, we're looking at the remains or the legacies or the monuments of our genetic cousins that were here before we were. So I think, I think we're looking at a very huge story. We've got cousins out there. They may still be out there. And, one branch of the family is here, and they came here and kind of kick-started us into existence.
And is it possible that we did not have ET visitations? I think we did, but is it possible we didn't? Merely, we had ancient ancestors on this planet.
Well, I think both, George. That's an excellent question. And my model of thinking about it is probably very similar to yours, especially after doing this particular book. That if we're going to talk about ancient extraterrestrial contact, and I think there's abundant evidence that something of that nature did occur, then I think what we're looking at in terms of that contact is precisely some branch of the human genus, some branch of the human family that came here and discovered an evolutionary process underway and like I said, tried to kind of kickstart it and give it a jump and basically engineered humanity into existence. We have to hold open that possibility again because we are dealing with legends of that sort and the details managed to dovetail. In fact, let's mention one thing that's very significant in that regard, George.
Okay.
If we look at the legends of the Mayans and the Aztecs that my friend Scott and I examine in The Grid of the Gods, one of the things that struck us as very, very strange is that in the Aztec doctrine, for example, you have the idea of five different ages or what they call five suns, all right? And one of the peculiar things that they connect that doctrine to, just as do the Mayans, is that in each age there is a different humanity, all right? Now, many people leap on that and say, well, that's just kind of a proto-theosophical doctrine. I don't think that's what they're talking about, because if you read their texts, what they're talking about are continued manipulations of the human species by somebody in each of these ages. And if that's the case, then, you're dealing either with manipulation or they have a very good handle on evolutionary theory.
Yeah.
But either way you look at it, George, you're dealing with people that have a very sophisticated view, and that view in turn implies that at some point they had a sophisticated scientific background long ago that led to those views.
So let's jump start it and come up to where we are today.
Okay.
How much more have we learned than what you think we knew a long time ago?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful question. I think based on the research I did in Genes and Giants, that we are getting, George, to the point that we used to be. And the reason I say that is twofold. If you look at the implied science in some of these ancient texts, it's of a twofold nature. You're dealing with a very sophisticated biological science. You're dealing with a very sophisticated ability to do genetic engineering that we are just now beginning to be able to do. In other words, we are now, George, engineering chimerical creatures, creations that are half human, half animal, and so on and so forth. We've engineered cats that glow in the dark and, you know, all sorts of bizarre things. So we are looking at our return to the level of science implied by those ancient texts in terms of biology. And then the second thing I think that we are looking at, and again, and this is such an excellent, important question, is that if you read those ancient texts, they imply also an extremely sophisticated physics. And I think that, again, if you look at modern accomplishments in physics, if you look at modern accomplishments in engineering with nanotechnology, we're beginning to crack the codes of quantum computing and so on and so forth. All of this, I think, indicates that we are, again, returning to the state of development that we had in those mists of prehistory. So I think, yeah, I think we're on the cusp of the very same type of civilization.
Let's get some of your let's get your take, Joseph, on the FBI releasing the vault, a memo, an incredible memo about what I think was Roswell, New Mexico, maybe also other areas where they talked about three crashed craft, alien bodies. What do you think's going on here? I mean, you've looked at this through a lot of your work over the years.
Yes.
What's happening?
George, you know, the only way I can rationalize it, and again, it's an excellent question, and I'm at this juncture kind of unsettled about it. I must be quite honest. And the reason why is I think you could be looking at, on the one hand, a controlled release of information. In other words, someone wants this out at this time. And I think the reason that they may want it out at this time is I'm kind of in agreement with Richard Hoagland here. I think that we've been looking at a kind of a covert war that's been taking place not only here on Earth, but up above in outer space. And I think to a certain extent, we may be looking at a possible release of information by elites that want us to know these things. I mean, my word, George, they've also released the factor and verified the fact now that memorandum of President Kennedy ordering the CIA to release all this information to NASA concerning UFOs is more or less a true memorandum. And, you know, I've talked about that memorandum in some of my books. I know that Richard has in some of his and many others have as well. And I have always believed that it was, in fact, genuine. And now they're releasing information that tells us basically that it was. So, yeah, I have to conclude that these elites, George, for some reason, they're preparing us for something, is what it boils down to. I think they're preparing us for some sort of process of increasing gradual leaks. I'm not on the disclosure bandwagon. I don't think that they're ever going to come right out in a big, beautiful, magical day of revelation, but I do think that they are leaking these things because, again, like I say, the technology, George, that we're reaching is so reminiscent of the civilization and culture that was described in these ancient texts, and I think that these elites have to be thinking that they may be in contact with some of these genetic cousins, and we'd better get ready.
Well, I think so, too. Was there anything unsettling about your research when you were putting genes, giants, monsters, and men together?
Oh, my word, yes. Yes, there was. It wasn't even any one specific thing, George. One of the most unsettling things to me was this constant feeling I kept getting as I was researching all the archaeological data, not only with Cremo and Thompson and some of the things that they've uncovered, but some things that other archaeologists, I've mentioned Adrian Mayer and other archaeologists have uncovered in this country. I kept getting the distinct feeling, George, again, that we were looking at a massive cover-up or reluctance to talk about, let's put it that way, a reluctance to talk about these things on the part of standard archaeology. And again, if you aren't willing to talk about these things, that means there's something about them that has to be unsettling to the professional academic. And again, I think all of it is due to the fact that we are dealing with clear evidence, not only of a very ancient, sophisticated civilization, but that it had some sort of interplanetary extent. And the implication, therefore, is, once again, that we may have members of the human family out there. And if that's the case, then, you know, they may be coming back. And that ties into the other big unsettling thing that I mentioned in the first hour, is if these stories, and it's a mighty big if, let's admit, but if these stories, George, are true, that we are engineered into existence by a group of people with an agenda, then this means we're property. So if they're coming back, you know, the implication is they might be coming back to claim their property.
Sure.
And the problem here, George, is now humanity, as I've indicated, has the technology to fight back. So, you know, it's a pretty nasty scenario that emerges from all of this, and that probably was the most unsettling thing that I found.
You know, since I was a boy, I would always look toward the heavens.
Yes.
The stars at night, Joseph, and I was just mesmerized by all of this.
Yes, you and me both.
Yeah, and at a very young age, I just started to make up my own mind, my own conclusions.
Yes.
That there's more to this universe than meets the eye. I was always very spiritual, not really religious. I wasn't an organized type of religious. You know, I went to Catholic school and,
right,
you know, catechism classes, and, you know, I did the church thing. But the older I got, I realized that, you know, you don't need organized religion to believe in God. Or,
right,
or whatever you want to call this.
Right.
But I am concluding at this point in my life that there is something out there in the universe that is extremely intelligent.
Yes.
That has put us on this planet, in this universe, for a purpose.
Yes.
And it's not merely to exist every day and, you know, to go to a baseball game or do whatever we do. It's to enhance this internal soul of ours for some bigger picture. And
yes,
I don't know yet what that bigger picture is, but I am totally convinced that there's more to this than we think.
Well, I have to agree with you, and agree with you on a number of things. I, like you, have come to the conclusion that the implications of this are so huge that increasingly, as I advance in years, I have little to do with organized religion. But yet, at the same time, like you, I think all of this has vast spiritual implications. And I agree with you. This is for some purpose. And I think, really, if you look at the body of research that I've done, at the body of research that other people in this field have done, I think most of us are coming to a similar conclusion. There is a purpose to all of this, although dissecting and divining what it might be is such a huge problem, because in order to do so, you must account for all of the legends, of all of the traditions. You can't lock yourself into one system and think that you have all the keys to the puzzle. And that's a huge task, because each culture construes that spiritual purpose slightly differently. And I think they've all got a piece of the puzzle. They've all got a clue to the puzzle. It's the problem is assembling the pieces of that puzzle, and that's the difficult thing.
We started off the interview talking about giants,
yes,
and monsters.
Yes.
Let's talk about the war against the giants. Who would have conducted the war against the giants besides the Greeks?
Well, this is another very, very interesting question. If you look at all of the lore, the Greeks have their version, the Mayans, the Aztecs, the Hopi, the Iroquois. When I investigated this subject, George, I was astounded at the parallels between all of these very, very divergent cultures. One thing clearly emerges, and that is that there appears to be some sort of worldwide program of war against these giants, all right? In other words, it's not just a Greek thing. It's the Iroquois are doing it, the Hopi are doing it, the Aztecs are doing it, the Mayans are doing it. Basically, everybody's doing it. And they all have different reasons for why they're doing it. In some cases, the giants are kidnapping people and quite literally eating them, cannibalism. And in other cases, you get the explanation, you know, from the Bible and from the Aztecs that their sexual practices were somehow aberrant or abhorrent for whatever reason. But again, if you put it into the context of the cosmic war thesis that I advanced in that book, there is a very interesting clue in the Mesopotamian texts, and I want to mention it here because it's the background for Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And the clue, George, is that this is a kind of a civil war. In other words, it's a war taking place between various branches of the pantheon of the gods. And the ultimate motivation for the war, if you read the Vedic texts, if you read the Mesopotamian texts, is somebody wants to control an extraordinarily powerful technology or to prohibit others from gaining and applying that technology. So we're looking, even in that sense, George, we're looking at kind of a metaphor of today's society as various world powers are trying to prevent other countries from gaining access to nuclear technology and so on and so forth. In other words, the motivations of this war, whatever it was, wherever it occurred, the motivations for this war were very, very modern. And that's what makes me think that these ancient texts are describing something that actually happened. So these giants enter into the picture, I think, as part of a bigger picture. They are players, they are soldiers in the combat that is involved for the control of this technology. And I'll be very blunt. I think, George, that some of this technology had to have been genetic in nature. In other words, someone wanted to control the processes and issues of life itself, and that's what had to be denied, and that's what had to be fought for.
Yeah, I think so, and you've hit it on the head once again with this latest work, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men.
Well, thank you.
Where do you get this book, Joseph?
The book is available right now at Amazon. It's also, I have a web store up on my website now, so people can actually order the books right off my website, which is www.GizaDeathStar.com. And again, they can contact the publisher, which is Farrell House, and order the book directly from them as well.
All right, Joseph Farrell, we're going to take a surprise guest for you next half hour when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. The other book you've got coming out in a few months, in May, you said? Okay.
Yeah.
So it ties into this, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely. The Grid of the Gods, I just heard from my publisher today, and he's saying the end of May. That's the book I wrote with my friend Scott DeHart. And that book, that's a sequel to The Cosmic War. And if you look at the books in that series, it's The Cosmic War, The Philosopher's Stone, Babylon's Banksters, and Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And then The Grid of the Gods will continue in that series of books.
People need to email you. Can they get to you through your website?
Yes, they can. There's a contact button there, George, and if they hit that contact button, that'll send right directly to my email. The only thing I ask is that people use all capitals in the subject header so that if it's something important they want to talk to me directly about, that I'll know to open it, because I get hundreds of emails a day.
You'll get many more today, that's for sure, in the Joseph's website. Is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll come back with more. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with them right here on Coast to Coast AM. Sure is, and we're talking Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men with Joseph Farrell, the surviving elites of the cosmic war and their hidden agenda. Fascinating discussion with Joseph, and we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. You know, when you write a book, as I have, as Joseph Farrell has, you put in special acknowledgments to people that you care about, people who have helped you get to where you are, not only in your life and your career, but also with this book. And it's kind of neat to read the acknowledgments to see who the individual truly admires and cares about in this particular time sequence. And, you know, I've written acknowledgments about my kids and people I care about, and my parents and things like that. Well, in this book, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, I'm reading the acknowledgments that Joseph Farrell put in. And here's one of the paragraphs. It says, "The same likewise must be said for my friend Richard C. Hoagland. who also, over many emails and phone calls these past 2 years, has made his own observations and contributions to this book, particularly in how space anomalies fit into the larger picture. I hope I have done some justice to his thoughts here. Thank you, Richard. So let's bring in Richard Hoagland for the half hour here. And see, Richard, has Joseph done justice to your thoughts?
Good morning. Well, I don't quite know yet, except for what I've heard tonight, because the book that he had the publisher send me has not arrived yet. So I'm gleaning these tantalizing bits and pieces from listening to you guys.
Joseph Richard Hoagland.
Hi, Joseph.
It's almost like this is your life, Joseph.
Yeah. Oh, my.
But anyways, I wanted to bring you on, Richard, because you understand this as well as anybody, and you're the one who recommended Joseph to our program many, many years ago.
That's right.
Yep, you did. And I just wanted you to just give us your input into this.
Well, you know what I find fascinating is that there's a group of us, and there aren't very many, because this is very hard work. People think, you know, out in radio land, that they think that we are cleaning up and that we are going to our Swiss bank accounts and making millions of dollars. Yeah, Joseph is laughing because he knows where I'm going with this. This is hard work. We pay more than we actually make.
Yeah.
You know, we basically live for nothing but our work. If some of us have relationships, they suffer because, you know, we are so devoted to trying to figure out what the heck is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always pleased when Joseph writes a new book, because it's like Christmas. I can't wait. And then, you know, I try to pace it out and make it last as long as I can. And then I get to the end, and there's that feeling of, when's he going to write another one?
Well, see, you didn't sign mine, Joseph. I was going to put it up on eBay and make millions on it. Oh well. But
you know,
Rich, but you're right. I mean, in the anticipation for you, because I've read it, you will love it.
Amazing. Well, what I find interesting, just listening to the conversation tonight, is that Joseph and I are on the same page in so many things, and we haven't talked about these details.
Now, no, we haven't.
That has been the hallmark of our relationship from the very beginning. When Tim Ventura introduced us, what was it, what, 5 years ago, 4 years ago?
Yeah, I think about 4 or 5 years ago, Richard.
What was so eerie is how we had reached kind of the points in our research where we had gotten to the same place, but from totally different directions.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, exactly. My component of this, which so complements what he's done, again, from what I'm hearing in this book, is that we've got a solar system filled.
Yes.
With extraordinary, ancient, gargantuan, magnificent, awesome, mind-blowing ruins of a Type II civilization, to use Kardashev's term, which Kaku has borrowed freely and liberally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like we are prostrate in front of the gods. You can imagine what the elites realized when they finally got their first pictures of what's out there. And they found that everything in their ancient sacred texts, the stuff that we've never seen, the stuff that they've spent fortunes combing the globe to find a parchment here, a tablet there. I mean, the whole thing with Iraq still, I think, was about going and plundering the 80,000 tablets in the museum in Baghdad.
Yes.
That never saw the light of day after we basically invaded that country.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree.
So if we've got all that incredible stuff out there, how are the guys here approaching it? And God help us if the owners are coming back.
Yes, exactly. I think that it's fairly clear that, at least from the study of the activities of the elite that I try to undertake in this book, Richard, that this is one of their major concerns, and that's why I spent the time I did in the book with patent law and examining ancient texts in terms of modern patent law, because it's very, very clear once you compare the two that the law would say we're property. So, yeah, it poses some very thorny questions.
You know, what I've always found interesting, and there's been a lot of critics, not a lot, but a few persistent critics. There's a guy named Expat that's been out after me and Mike for years and years because of Dark Mission. Because in Dark Mission, we lay out a specific legal case by simply quoting the NASA charter.
Yes.
That under the chapter of, under the division of the U.S. Civil Code devoted to patent law, NASA is a DOD agency.
Yes.
It is a member of the Department of Defense. Under that specific provision of patent law, and people say to me constantly, well, why would you think that would make NASA, you know, military as opposed to civilian? And it all hinges, as you know, Joseph, on that key thing about patenting technology.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. No argument from me, Richard. I think, in fact, I think if you want to put what you said in Dark Mission about patent law with respect to NASA and what I say in Gene's Giants with respect to patent law and genetic engineering and ancient texts, I think you're looking at basically one and the same scenario. In other words, you're looking at two components of a very, very huge picture.
Well, the other component is that John Kennedy knew.
Yes.
Now, I noticed that when George brought up the question, and I find I'm doing it myself, it's like at some point we have to get pregnant. As of tonight, we have an official CI memo from the Office of the President of the United States of America, specifically directing the CIA to give UFO, it called them unknowns and knowns, information to the head of NASA, James Webb, who in turn was going to communicate this to the Soviets, to Premier Khrushchev and his people, all part of this campaign that Kennedy had worked on for years. Ever since he'd been elected, he wanted to get together with the Soviets, and instead of killing the human race in an all-out nuclear war, he wanted to involve the Soviet Union in this combined effort to go to the moon together and to share the prize. And the fact is tonight, that is a fact. That memo is an official memo. It came out under FOIA. It came out now under the Obama CIA, which I find very important.
Very interesting, yes.
And the dots are connecting. I mean, let me leap ahead. When you're talking about wars on elites and whether elites are on guard and they're trying to let some of us know, i.e. all of us know what's really going on, there is this most extraordinary and peculiar thing going on between the Obama administration and this damn royal wedding next week.
I know where you're going.
You know where I'm going, right?
Yes, I do.
The next shuttle mission, which is the last flight of the Endeavour shuttle, after which you will come home and be put in a museum in California, this last flight, STS-134, was originally supposed to take off last year, and they had all kinds of problems, George, and we've been on the show talking about some of these little technical problems.
Right.
They had to move it and move it and move it, and finally it was decided it was going to be April 19th. Yesterday, that mission was supposed to leave. Well, I'm in Amsterdam with Robin at the Secret Space Conference, and I get a note that Obama has moved the launch date of the last shuttle mission of Endeavour, STS-134, from the 19th to April 29th, which, of course, is the royal wedding date. Furthermore, he is launching it at 3:47 in the afternoon on Eastern Daylight Time, which translates to 19.47 Greenwich Mean Time, excuse me, and he and Michelle and the girls are going to be in attendance at the launch while the prince and princess are getting married in England.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Joseph, you take it from there, because to me, this is a tremendous window on this secret side of symbology, telling the British, particularly the City of London.
City of London, yes, the City of London.
Some major stuff that you talk about in Babylon Bankster. So take it away.
Well, yeah, I think you're right in terms of the publicity play here and the ritual that's involved. I think you're absolutely right, because, you know, as I detail in Babylon's Banksters, the whole scheme of the banksters has been to substitute real money, which is state-issued and debt-free, with their facsimile of money, which is nothing but monetized debt, circulating debt. And, of course, the City of London is steeped, Richard, in that tradition with the Bank of England and the connections between the Bank of England and the old Dutch banking families in Amsterdam, and then from Amsterdam back to Venice and so on and so forth. So this is a direct, in my opinion, I think it's a direct snubbing of the nose on the part of President Obama to that whole crowd in London. And you know as well as I do that at least in this country, the presence of the president and his family at the shuttle launching is going to upstage the royal wedding in terms of news coverage. So, you know, it's a direct snub, but it's a very subtle one, too. If you wouldn't think about it unless someone like you came along and pointed it out. So, yeah.
But you know, at the same time, it's not like Charles and Diana. You know, it's
well, no,
it's
no, no,
kid.
No, George, let me beg to differ with you.
Why?
The Queen could die tomorrow. Yeah. And Prince William would then be the King of England. You're dealing with a potential head of state within the potential of this president's administration.
What do you mean? What would happen to Prince Charles?
Well, but Prince Charles is I'm not sure what the rules of succession are, but I have a feeling
he would be the king.
Well,
Charles would be the king.
He's the Queen's son.
But I think there's another aspect of this that Americans are under a tremendous misunderstanding. The crown still has extraordinary power in England.
Yes. Strange extraordinary power.
Yeah, yes, you're right, George. It's very, very strange, the power and influence that they exercise, because it's very, very subtle. But we have to remember, as Americans, one very important thing, that no law passed by Parliament is a law until it is signed by the monarch. And there is nothing in the English Constitution, which is, of course, an unwritten constitution, there is nothing in the English Constitution that compels a monarch to sign a Bill of Parliament into law. So, in other words, the monarchy is still very, very important. It still has real power. And Americans are under the misimpression that you know, it's nothing but a figurehead monarchy. And the other problem that we have to take into account is that the House of Windsor has enormous wealth and deep, deep connections to this whole banking fraternity. So I think the symbolism here of President Obama's changing of the launch date and announcement that he's and his family are going to be there rather than as a head of state attending a royal wedding in London, I think the analysis here is very right on. It's dead on, because this is a direct snub.
Well, remember the first thing that kind of raised some eyebrows when the president took over the Oval Office, the first thing he did the first day. Remember what that was, Joseph?
No, I don't.
He sent Winston Churchill's bust back to England.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that.
Which
yes,
had
I
been
do.
In the Oval Office since FDR.
FDR, that's right. That's
now,
right.
I'm thinking this is the second Declaration of American Independence. And the reason I'm thinking that is what occurred Friday night, the 8th of April, a couple weeks ago, when the president came out at 11:04 to deliver the message that the U.S. government was not shutting down, and that because they had managed to reach a deal across the aisle with the Republicans for $39 billion in cuts, 39 twice 19.5.
Five, right.
He made this address to basically tell everybody, calm down, the government's going on, everything's going to be open. And he did not do the address from the Oval Office. He did it from the Blue Room.
Yeah.
And in the open window behind him, you could see in the darkness, lit up in this ghostly fluorescence of the mercury vapor lamps, the Washington Monument, the spire of the Egyptian obelisk to, of course, George Washington. Flanking him over his shoulders were two presidents. And, George, this is going to be a little kind of quiz for you.
Let's see
how sharp you are as an historian. The guy on his left was Madison. The guy on his right was Thomas Jefferson. The guy in the middle, represented by the monument, was Washington. What do all of these three presidents of all our history, these three presidents uniquely have in common?
Common, yeah.
The Declaration of Independence.
Well, okay. Well,
yes.
Yeah,
yes.
But that's okay. It's something more relevant to tonight's discussion. Let's put it that way.
They were all Masons.
Okay, close, but no cigar.
Oh, come on, Richard. I'm getting real close. I'm warm.
Okay. They all declared war on England.
That was my third guess.
Now, what does that mean symbolically? See, what people don't get when I talk about symbolism is that, and Joseph, you know, if I'm wrong here, tell me, but there is a dual language. There is the
yes.
public language.
Yes.
And then there's the deep, elite, symbolic language that goes back thousands of years.
Well, let me ask you about that, though, Richard. Who actually sits back and comes up with the symbolism for this to occur? Because, you know, as an outsider, I couldn't think of that. Somebody's got to be there that says, all right,
do you know
put
about
this
diplomatic
picture...
codes?
No, I really don't.
Joseph?
Well, yeah, I think George, this illustration may help you. If you recall, when France surrendered to Hitler in 1940, mm-hmm. Hitler chose a very deliberate symbolism to conduct the surrender. He chose the very railroad car that Germany had surrendered to France in World War I to conduct the ceremony in, and he put it on the exact spot.
Okay.
That
okay.
You've got a similar kind of symbolism, I think, is what Richard is arguing
sure.
here.
But I mean, he was turning the knife in and he was twisting it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And what this was the other night was Obama's declaration of war, I believe, against the City of London, backed up by him upstaging this world-class event with
right.
what's going to turn out to be an even bigger world-class event because of his participation in the last shuttle flight. And don't forget, the commander of this mission, Mark Kelly, has a wife, a congressman from Arizona, Gabrielle Giffords, who came within a whisker, within microns, of being assassinated by an assassin's bullet to the head.
Yeah.
So true. And by the way, they say that Prince Charles would become king if Queen Elizabeth ever abdicates her throne or dies.
Right.
But what they say is she may never die, and he will just merely give it to William.
Ah.
Yeah, there is.
Which is
yeah.
possible. If she's a reptilian, like David Icke says,
yeah.
she'll stay on forever.
Well, I have heard talk of that, George. I've heard talk that the plan is that Charles would abdicate in favor of Prince William, but you know, the royal family itself.
Well, there's a very important reason for that, and that is that William and Catherine represent the unification of two warring factions of the House of Windsor after about 300 years, called the Sophia Succession and the Jacobite Succession, that goes back to James I.
Richard, I want to